All right. Good morning, everybody. How you doing? This is great to see so many people here to talk about trans and gender variant people's health. And as Sel mentioned, my name is Kellen. I'm here representing the Center for American Progress as well as the Out to Enroll Initiative, which is an initiative that I run out of CAP that focuses on making sure that the benefits of the Affordable Care Act reach everyone who needs them, including transgender and gender variant communities. No relationships disclosed. And I'm going to be talking about three main points with regard to some of the current opportunities in trans health policy. Number one, data collection. It's a tough act to follow. Shannon, with your question about what are you going to do? Because ostensibly that's what we do in policy. We try to do something. And so I'm going to be talking about some of the things that we're trying to do, but also really going back to that grounding of what information do we have in order to make sure that we're doing the right things. Second, talking about health insurance coverage, particularly in the context of the Affordable Care Act, and then non-discrimination and access to coverage and services. And I'm really excited you all are joining me to talk about policy because I think it's pretty sexy. Come on, people. Policy gets me all hot and bothered too. Excellent, data collection. So starting off at the top, again, figuring out what do we know so that we can figure out where we need to go from here. The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, HHS, is supporting trans-related data collection across four broad areas. And I really break these out because I feel like particularly in maybe research land and policy land, we get stuck in our own particular little buckets with regard to how are we collecting data, what do we think of as appropriate sources of data, and really want to look at these four different areas where we are seeing some really incredible new opportunities for collecting more information that will help us make better decisions in the policy world. The first off is research. I know my audience here, hopefully, APHA folks. Researchers, trans and intersex issues are an NIH research priority. The NIH strategic plan is actually open for comment right now until the end of the day today. So please do go check it out. It talks a lot about research with regard to SGM, sexual and gender minorities. So there is an opportunity in that comment period to address some of the ways that NIH is conceptualizing who SGM populations, sexual and gender minorities, LGBT people, trans and gender variant folks are. And this is something that we hope will have a pretty significant impact on, for example, some of the funding that is available to look at some of the needs of trans and gender variant populations. Because to some of the points that have been made earlier, a lot of the reason why HIV looms so large is because that's where the money was. And that really hasn't changed. They're trying to change it, but we do need input from everybody to make sure that the priorities that NIH has identified are the correct ones from the perspectives of all of us, not only as researchers, but as folks who are doing this work in the field, and frankly, for those of us who are members of trans and gender variant communities. The Patient-Centered Outcomes Research Institute, PCORI, is also funding trans health research, scrambling to do so just as fast as it can, while Congress still lets it have its money. So number two, population surveys. Healthy people, is anybody here a healthy people user? Healthy people fan? Oh, thank heavens, okay. Usually when I talk about this, like people are like, healthy people what? And then I'm sad. So healthy people, the LGBT health topic area in Healthy People 2020 has several objectives, all of which are related to the collection of better data on sexual orientation and gender identity. Some of the surveys that HHS is prioritizing to try to respond to those objectives include the Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance System, or the BRFIS. Does anyone have knowledge in your state, is the BRFIS using sexual orientation and gender identity questions? See some nods, yes. So this is a really big one, actually. CDC approved a SOGI, Sexual Orientation and Gender Identity module, 2 years ago. It is now in use by more than 25 states and territories. And if you are in a state that does not yet use the SOGI module, you can go to your BRFIS coordinator and ask that they do so. The Youth Risk Behavior Survey operates in much the same way. There are CDC-approved questions related to gender expression in particular. The Medicare Current Beneficiary Survey is adding questions on gender identity. The National Health Interview Survey does or does not include gender identity? Anyone? Does not. It includes sexual orientation? Yes. Yes. Exactly. There was a commentary that just closed on the NHIS. I hope people participated. There is an opportunity to add a gender identity question there as well. And with regard to what kinds of questions should be added to these surveys, Sari already mentioned the Genius Report, which is out there. You can take a look to see what some of the recommendations, if you will, or suggested opportunities, ideas for how to ask about gender identity in a population survey context. The third big area is administrative and program data. In particular, we're seeing a lot of work by folks working in the CMS Office of Minority Health to investigate trans and gender-variant people's health in Medicare claims. Medicare overturned its transgender exclusion in 2014. There are an estimated 3,000 people that they've been able to identify so far within the Medicare claims data who are trans or gender-variant. And I just want to make sure that everyone knows, too, this just happened this morning. The CMS Office of Minority Health is supporting 5 seats in the CMS Virtual Research Data Center. So you would have 36 months of access to restricted CMS data, and it is on a first-come, first-served basis. So if you want more information about that, you can ask me after the presentation. The Uniform Data System, the UDS, in Federally Qualified Community Health Centers. We know Federally Qualified Community Health Centers, FQHCs, like Fenway and Howard Brown here in Chicago, serve an incredible number of LGBT people and offer, for example, the informed consent model of access to care that Sari was describing. The UDS does not currently collect data on LGBT populations, but it is going to start in 2016. So we will have data on LGBT populations, trans, gender variant, and sexual orientation minorities from FQHCs starting next year. Also, HIV and AIDS and mental health and substance use programs, such as those funded by HRSA, the Health Resources and Services Administration, the Ryan White program in particular, has been collecting data on trans and gender variant folks, not in a very good way, but they're working on it. Mental health and substance use programs from the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, SAMHSA. And then in the context of the Affordable Care Act, the federal and state health insurance marketplace applications. They do not currently collect any information about sexual orientation or gender identity, which is a problem because if folks have been paying attention to the discussion about the Affordable Care Act, one of the big questions is it working? Is it reaching the people who need it? When it comes to LGBT populations, we don't know. So one of the things that we're working with the state-based marketplaces and the federally facilitated marketplace, healthcare.gov, is to add sexual orientation and gender identity demographic questions to the marketplace application. And you can see down there, this is I hope it's a little small, so going over to this version, this is what we're suggesting for addition to the marketplace application. And an interesting thing about this is that it actually fits in the beginning of the application where the current gender question is. Because we're seeing a lot of trans folks having a lot of trouble getting through the marketplace application process because what do you put down for your gender? Do you put down what the Social Security Administration says? Do you put down what your passport says, your birth certificate, your driver's license, your military ID, or how you wake up in the morning? So figuring out how to change that question in a way that better reflects the experiences and needs and identities of trans and gender variant people. This is based on the two-step model that came out of research in Philadelphia in the late 90s and has been adapted and refined by the Center for Excellence in Transgender Health at UCSF. So this would mean that the folks who are going through the marketplace application, whether they are trans or not, will look at both of these questions. We're hoping, based on research that has been done, methodologically speaking, that the non-trans folks will make it through without messing up the data for everyone else. And that these data will be useful not only for enrollment purposes, but also in looking at the experiences of trans and gender variant people in marketplace enrollment. And the last piece, or the last big area of data collection I want to talk about is electronic health records. The Institute of Medicine reports from 2011 and 2012 both recommend LGBT data collection. And we just got some news out of CMS earlier this year that the federal meaningful use program requirements or stage 3 will require certified EHR systems, electronic health record systems, to have the capacity to collect sexual orientation and gender identity data. So there's a lot of work going on now to figure out exactly what that looks like in terms of operationalizing that requirement. You can find more information about that at www.doaskdotell.org. So looking at the second big piece of my presentation, health insurance coverage, because there are a lot of reasons for liking, there are a lot of reasons for disliking the Affordable Care Act, but there really is no denying that it is the biggest change to the U.S. health system in a long time. And when we look at the Affordable Care Act, in a lot of ways, it is a health insurance reform law, because that is one of the things that has been most wrong with our health system for the longest amount of time. So looking at whether the Affordable Care Act is actually expanding access to coverage, this is among all U.S. adults, sources the Gallup poll. You can see there in the middle of 2013, this sudden drop in on insurance. Does anyone know why would that have started happening right around then?
Marketplaces.
Exactly. Thank you, Lois. Marketplaces open right there where you start to see that big decline in uninsurance. This is also from the Gallup poll, which has been asking folks since 2012, do you identify as LGBT? Don't even get me started methodologically speaking, but it has given us some data on uninsurance rates among all LGBT adults. You can see it declining all the way across this time period between 2013 and 2014. Looking at coverage among low and middle income LGBT adults, so people with incomes between 0 and 400% of the poverty level, which are those folks who are potentially eligible for financial assistance to get coverage under the Affordable Care Act. In 2013, this is research that we did at the Center for American Progress, 34% of those folks were uninsured. By 2014, that number had dropped significantly to 26%, but that still meant that going into the last open enrollment period and going into this open enrollment period, there are a lot of LGBT people who still don't have coverage. And particularly looking again at transgender people, the numbers from 2013 are based on small sample size, so please take them with a grain of salt, but close to 60% of trans folks with incomes under 400% of the poverty level were uninsured. 2014, we saw that drop significantly, but still very, very large numbers of transgender people who cannot get coverage. One of the big reasons why trans people haven't been able to get coverage is related to discrimination. So this cartoon here, unfortunately very relevant for some of today's discussions, I want to see if your company's religious views match my family's health concerns. And when it comes to the health concerns of trans people, for the most part, health insurance carriers' views have not lined up with trans people's needs. So I'm going to skip ahead to trans and LGB non-discrimination in the Affordable Care Act, with a particular focus on Section 1557, which provides protections on the basis of gender identity and sex stereotyping. This is on the federal marketplace application. Under federal law, discrimination is not permitted on bases that include sexual orientation and gender identity. The Section 1557 proposed rule is open for comment right now. It is open until November 9th. Some of the things that the proposed rule are non-discrimination on the basis of gender identity and sex stereotyping, codifying that, getting rid of transgender-specific insurance exclusions, requiring non-discrimination in access to services and facilities, and requiring trans people to be treated in accordance with their gender identity in, for example, hospital room assignments. Please do go and check out that proposed rule. We need everyone to comment on its importance. We're seeing the Office for Civil Rights already doing something to use 1557, even while the proposed rule is being put together. And there are a bunch of new rules that are part of the Affordable Care Act as well. If anyone wants to talk about the Affordable Care Act, please don't be shy. I love it. I mean, it has a lot of problems, but it's doing a lot in order to give more trans people access to the care we need. So thanks.
Thank you so much. We're moving on to Jyoti Lynn Paul, who's the director of the Trans Life Center, a program of the Chicago House, since August 2014. She has previously served as the Trans Life Center Trans Advisory Board since its inception in 2012. Jyoti has over 25 years of experience in providing clinical services, supervision, management, program design, and program administration. Prior to coming to Chicago House, her career focused in substance abuse treatment and mental health, with experience working with individuals and families with chronic homelessness, poverty, trauma, chronic illness, and HIV. She received her master's in social work from the University of Chicago's School of Social Service Administration in 1989, and Jyoti is an out and proud woman of trans experience. Sister, mother, daughter, artist, seeker of truth, and lover of all things purple.
Yeah.
So good morning, everybody. I think my coffee has kicked in. This is a good thing. As has been said, I'm the director of Chicago House's Trans Life Center for just over a little bit over a year right now. And if you go onto the Chicago House website, there's a video. And they were talking about showing that video, and I said, not so much. Because the video really focuses on, as part of our services, we have a 9-bed house, residential kinds of services, housing services for homeless individuals in the trans community. In our overall work, that has often been held up as like the primary model of what we do, and it really is a very small part. And I want to talk about the bigger picture that is far more impactful on healthcare than a 9-bedroom house in Chicago's Edgewater community. I would like to say that healthcare for the trans community is housing. Healthcare is legal assistance. Healthcare is employment. Healthcare is safe spaces. Healthcare is gender affirmation and gender affirming. That if we're not providing these things, we're really not providing healthcare for the trans community. Our model is extremely drop-in center based. We talk about having 5 services, but 2 days a week, and possibly 3 days a week in the near future, we run a drop-in that is trans-specific, 18 and over, and we're kind of it's one of those uses of don't ask, don't tell that might be positive, as we don't ask for proof of age coming in. So for certain services, individuals under 18, this is Edward Benai said this, are welcome. And it's the only drop-in that I know of that is all age and trans-specific. In Chicago, you can find a lot of youth drop-ins, a lot of LGBT drop-ins, but you don't find the kinds of drop-in services that we run that are trans-specific and age-inclusive as much as possible. And in those settings, our model is actually connection to a variety of resources, the kinds of resources that I started with, connection to housing resources, including our 9-bedroom house, our 1 scattered site unit, but also through the Chicago Central Referral System list, connection to other housing providers. I like to think about, you know, what we've accomplished is really, okay, so we've housed 9 folks in this house. In the last fiscal year, there were 40 trans individuals who were homeless who we put on the CRIS list and who were pulled off the CRIS list for housing in Chicago trans communities. That's huge. That's a total of 50 trans individuals housed in a year's time. And we see when we house people, their health improves. We serve to link individuals to the legal services. 65 individuals in the last fiscal year served. Many, many name changes and gender marker changes provided through our programming, through those connections, which means more trans individuals going out into the world with IDs that match. Because when we talk about access to healthcare, when we talk about system fatigue, what's the first thing that an individual shows when walking into a healthcare clinic? Can I see your ID? And it's the first thing that trans individual is going to go, oh, what does that mean? What does that mean for me today? Having that identification congruent with gender identity is huge for beginning to decrease some of that system access barriers. And the drop-in flexibility is extremely important. It allows us to be very much patient or client, or we often use the word participant center, because when an individual comes in and sees us, we are there for what they need. We have very few individuals that come to us, and we have a provider on site for our drop-in, a medical provider through Heartland, through our partnership with Heartland Health Outreach. But they do not, our participants often don't come in for healthcare. They come in because she's homeless, or she wants help with a name change and gender market change. And we serve probably, I believe it's about 80% transgender women of color in a, through the bulk of our services. We are designed to serve all individuals who identify as transgender. We don't define that. We allow that for participants of all genders and all races. Providing the services, connection to services that we believe are the services that those in the trans communities who are most marginalized, these are the things they need. And so we expect those who are most marginalized to show up. And what we see is it's primarily trans women of color who come for our services. Most of them show up looking for one or two specific services. And then they find out, oh, this is a program that can connect us to employment services. Oh, you have a healthcare provider? I'm not currently getting my hormones. The number one, and it's been talked about already, so I'm not going to go in. The number one request when it comes to healthcare is hormones. And for the reasons in particular, I had to hold my tongue when Shannon asked the question because I knew the answer. We've talked about it for years. Hormones. Because they want to travel life through a safe space. And those safe spaces are important. We offer this drop-in as a safe space, but with the goal of providing those specific services that offer safer spaces out in the world. There are limits to operating drop-ins as safe spaces. There's only so many hours of a day, and then folks have to go somewhere else. And so it's very much based on what the individual is looking for. Flexibility, drop in, no appointment needed. And offers the service there and then. What I think is very powerful of the model of what we do on a drop in basis is if a woman or a man comes in and says, I need housing, or fall into binary and I shouldn't, or those who are don't identify along the binary who are trans, I'm looking for housing. We connect them to that waiting list and talk with them about specific resource. I need legal help. They see our lawyer. They don't get an appointment for going to a clinic for medical, for going to a law office. They see a lawyer. They see a medical provider. They walk out with something tangible that they didn't walk in with. It's not a promise of something down the road. It's a service there and then. Because homeless, trans individuals living in poverty, marginalized, who when getting on that bus are going to be thinking, what am I going to face? Come to these kinds of services when they're ready and only when they're ready. And if we're not available to meet that need in that moment, we miss that window with that individual. And so we are set up to meet everybody's window when it opens. Not when we feel like it, not when we think you're ready, but rather when you say you're ready and you come to us. And we've been trying, and we've expanded to the south side, and we're looking to the west side to cover where trans individuals live, because it's all over, not just the one big LGBTQ center on the north side of the center in Halsted, where we have one of our drive-in tenants. So we have this system that is based on participant-centered, not program-centered kinds of services. A couple of thoughts on services like this. We found that having services that are trans-specific is very important. And there is some importance to folks coming to us who see and say, oh, I see faces like mine. But I'd like to couple that with a couple of caveats. And one of those is that it has to be balanced with confidentiality and professionalism. Systems that just have trans faces and don't have high quality services and professionalism and confidentiality, the women who come to us and the men who come to us and see a face and say, I was partying with this woman and listened to her gossip yesterday, are not coming back. They need to be trans-informed. I was, quick story, since we're storytellers. I had bronchitis a couple of months ago and ended up in urgent care. The doctor says, yeah, I see what you're on. I'm a little concerned because you have blood in your phlegm. This could be a pulmonary embolism. With your hormones, kind of need you to go to the emergency room now. You can get there, but I would call an ambulance if you say anything else. And so I go. He knew that that was a possible issue and looked for it. But he was also talking about bronchitis and other things. He didn't see me and ask me about all sorts of other things, because that can often be. And I didn't have to be focusing on HIV, because the other thing that we found is we are not HIV specific. While our brand actually looks at HIV, our services have nothing to do with HIV status. And that's very important to take that stigma out of what we do and to fund services that have nothing to do with HIV-specific healthcare.